Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Courtney Angela Berkich. She's the author, most recently, of The Stone Fields, An Epitaph for the Living. She's written a book of short stories as well called Stillness. Both of the books are published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Originally, Stillness is now available in paperback from Picador. Now, I read that you had begun this memoir, The Stone Fields, and then interrupted it to write the book of stories. Can you tell me what that was like, since they share the same subject to some extent?
They do. They have, I think, a very similar subject between them. And it's sort of an interesting thing. I had started with The Stone Fields, which is a nonfiction. It's part memoir, part sort of a reimagined history. So I was, in fact, able to do a lot of novel-type, fictional-type work in it. But I realized at a certain point as I was writing it that there were a tremendous number of stories that I wanted to tell that were not fitting into the nonfiction. Somehow the scope of the nonfiction, it couldn't contain them. A lot of those stories were sort of based on fact, but became very much fiction based on fact. And that's really where the stories came out. And at a certain point, I just sat down. I realized that the sort of mammoth combination of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry that I was working on, I had to break it up. I had to separate it. And that's how the stories really came about. And it was actually one or two stories that I had thought to incorporate in the nonfiction that I then separated, and they became the basis for the book of short stories.
Because it seemed to me that, had you begun in terms of the memoir with the story of your grandmother?
I did. That was very much the first story that I began with, the idea of my grandmother's childhood, the years that she had been living in Herzegovina and then in Sarajevo, and then the war years. And because my grandmother died many years before my birth, obviously a lot of it was reimagined. I based those chapters, those sections, on interviews that I had conducted with my father, with other surviving family members. But the style of those sections, there's definitely a fictional element to them. Obviously, I couldn't know what the exact conversations, what the dialogue was like. I couldn't know necessarily a pattern on a dress that my grandmother wore when she was 13 years old. And so this sort of oriented me towards a more imaginative, perhaps, type of writing. I wasn't constrained so much by the things that I had seen. And that's actually really very much where the impetus for the other stories came from. The stories in Stillness, which are based largely around the wars in Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina, they are, while based on a lot of facts, obviously I've taken tremendous liberty, and there's no one character that is a real person. And so to a very large degree, it's reimagined. And that jumping off point really did come with my grandmother's story, in fact, because back, I think it was in 1993, I was living with her sisters in Zagreb, Croatia during the war. And that's the point at which I got this idea to write a family history.
Had you met her?
I didn't. She died in 1969, so she died 3 years before I was born.
Because one of the most important figures in my family for me was my grandmother, and I'm very interested. Proust wrote about his grandmother mm-hmm. a great deal. I'm very interested in what draws people in particular to write about grandmothers. What was the first story you heard about her that you wanted to tell to others?
Well, my father had always spoken about the war years in Sarajevo and just about how very difficult those years were. And my grandmother...
Wait, which war?
Oh, sorry. This is the Second World War. This is the Second World War. And my grandmother and my father and my uncle, they came from this very small village in Herzegovina, which is really quite a rural area, quite a homogenous area. And she came as a widow with her two sons to Sarajevo. and was living there. And I think it was a very difficult period for her. But my father has also said, especially in the 30s before the war began, it was a very happy period for her because she had somehow shrugged off the confines of this very small, rural, occasionally very narrow village. And she had come to the city. And sort of the city was a place of limitless possibility for her. She was able to send her sons to very good schools to ensure that they would have a good education. And she enjoyed the fact that the city was so diverse, that it was a city in every sense of the word. Then with the Second World War, of course, things got much more difficult. Her partner in those years was Jewish. He was picked up. She was also arrested. He had been hiding out in their apartment for some time. And these were the sort of images that came at me all the way from childhood, and I gleaned them from my father. And it's very interesting because I wasn't given the full picture. It was a period that was very difficult for my father to talk about, in fact. But I would get these almost like snapshots, these sort of instant visions of her, these pictures of her through the years.
This is my fantasy about how this book, The Stone Fields, An Epitaph for the Living by my guest Courtney Angela Berkich, came into being. There's a story of the grandmother, but there's a question. How is it to be framed? You've been in Bosnia.
Yes.
And you've done interviews mostly with women who are in states of waiting for their sons or husbands to come back home.
Right.
Many of them have been buried in mass graves. I think the stories, in some sense, give you the metaphor of excavation. And then that allows you to write about your later experience as an excavator in the grave fields.
Absolutely. I think both in terms of excavation, straightforward excavation, in terms of a story that is in the book of short stories called Adio Querido, which is about an Argentine forensic scientist who's working in Bosnia, so quite literally excavation in that sense, and also a metaphorical excavation. This idea of the waiting, missing persons, particularly women who are left behind and who are waiting for brothers or husbands or sons, this is something that really, it obsessed me. Quite frankly, it obsessed me. It still does. The idea that anybody should live a life in that type of limbo, I think there's probably nothing I could imagine that would be quite as horrible as that. My grandmother, I remember once asking my father, well, how did she know at the end of the war that Josef Finzi, her boyfriend in those years, was dead? And my father sort of looked at me, and I said to him, is it possible that somebody told her? Did she find out the information from his family or from someone who had survived the camp and had come back and had told her? And my father shook his head, and he said, no, she figured out because he just simply didn't come back. It was actually probably the most difficult passages that I've ever written were actually those passages in the Stone Fields where I'm discussing that about my grandmother, about my father. And much of what I'm writing in there is seen through my father's eyes. And honestly, because it was so difficult for my father and because it was so difficult for him to talk about, it was actually very difficult for me to write about.
Yes, it seems to me, if you'll, you know, pardon me, because some of it is you know, shocking and morbid and horrible, but it seems to me that the subject of digging up bodies from a mass grave,
right,
is a writer's subject. It comes, its horror comes naturally to the mind and the imagination and the hand, whereas the things that a father doesn't talk about,
right,
and has become habitually silent about are much harder to get at.
Absolutely, absolutely. And they're both forms of excavation. I think the excavation that I did with my father in terms of hearing the stories, as far as having him divulge the details of those years and really just how bad it was, and those feelings of terror and those feelings of horror, and that extreme sadness at the end of the war when it became completely clear that he would not be returning from the camps. They were very difficult to excavate. The physical excavation that I do in terms of the forensic work that I did in Eastern Bosnia, it was also difficult, but in a completely different way. And what's very interesting to me looking back is that the reason that I went to Eastern Bosnia, and it was after, it came on the heels of that year interviewing women in the refugee and displaced person population. And I went because I had this idea that I wanted to do something concrete. I had this idea that this year that I had spent taking data, having conversations, it was all well and good. But if I could just get out there, if I could get into the field, and if I could do something concrete, then this would be good because I would be doing something active. In retrospect, what I've realized is that was not necessarily the case. In fact, the other excavation that I was doing, it went a lot further, I think.
Now, it seems to me that someone, even though it was really in that case for a month, who is assembling bodies that have rotted or decomposed to the extent that they can't be distinguished one from another, that this is going to change the way you look at the rest of your life. And it seemed to me that the prologue of The Stone Fields is a very good example of how metaphor and perception are shaped by the circumstance of your life at that time. So I thought I'd ask my guest, Courtney Angela Berkich, to read the prologue of The Stone Fields, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
I placed a hand on his forehead, careful not to wake him, and let my fingers rest on the vein that pulsed in evening's thin light. Beneath the warm skin were the plates of his cranium, the sutures where entire continents met in his childhood and fused over the ocean of his mind. The gentle, breakable bones of his face were like china, or the hollow bones of birds. They were as fragile as calcified breath. The flow of his blood was like water singing through rock, and in my concentration I was only vaguely aware of figures standing on all sides of the bed. Lifting my head, I found myself looking through their bodies as through the fluid of memory. I turned them into glass and buried my face in him once again. Whether this angered or saddened them, I could not tell. Wind from the open window made the curtains dance and crept over my naked legs. Stiepan's Fur de Prey reminded me of dinosaur exhibits at a museum. There was something salamander-like about them. They started out small and graceful and metamorphosed into the sturdiness of the lumbar region, where they were the trunk of a stout oak. Ribs are the tines of a cage, I recited under my breath, and the sternum the thing that joins them. The sternum is variable. It can bow inward or out. It can have holes down its middle, tiny pinpricks, or be as smooth as the inside of a solid piece of bark. I brushed my eyelids against him, wondering what shape his had taken. I examined his hand, which rested on my hip. Undone, it is a jigsaw puzzle, and reassembling it takes concentration and patience. I had been told that you get better with time. The skin on Stepan's hip was taut and smooth. Although the pelvis is called the innominate, because there is no other shape in nature that it resembles, the construction had seemed elephantine to me. Here you can discern a man from a woman definitively. He stirred in his sleep. Sooner than I would have liked, he would return to the base and I would go back to my Zagreb apartment. I moved my right leg, which had become entangled in his. They had been like that in the ground, all arms and legs, and I shivered. I had not wanted to let that picture intrude while he held me, but it was inevitable, as was every memory of bones. Stepan sighed and stretched toward me in his sleep, burrowing his face into my neck. I continued to avoid the faces around the bed, realizing that his ghosts were vying with mine for position. Months had passed since my return from Bosnia, but at times they dwindled down to moments, and now I looked at Stjepan, wondering if his ghosts looked the same to him. They started to bend their heads over us, as if attempting resuscitation, and I closed my eyes. I found that I could not bring myself to look at them from one day to the next. A sudden change in breathing told me that he had awakened, and a moment later he wrapped legs and arms around me in a bear hug. He opened his eyes and looked at me solemnly, his breath making a few strands of my hair shiver as the curtains had done. My heart beat faster, and I smiled. I wondered whether I would recognize him by his bones.
Courtney Angela Berkich, reading from The Stone Fields. Now, as I was reading, I think it was the second grandmother section, there's a scene in which, having been taken sick, she's carried on a door as a stretcher.
Yes.
To the hospital. And it wasn't until then that I realized what that image of the faces around the beds came from. And so what we're doing in this book, we're beginning in a sense of displacement.
Right.
And she is bringing, although the reader can't know yet, the experience of having, you know, worked with bones. That's why she can define the tines of a cage, that the rib cage is. She has these things in her head from textbooks, but we're being given almost as if it's a poem.
Right.
And the images are meshing in ways that only the book can disentangle.
Right, right. I think that's very, very true. That first section, actually, it's interesting. It began as a poem. This prologue section in the book, I originally wrote it as a poem, and actually with no intention at that point of including it. It was only later that I realized how much that section had in relation to the other sections, how much it had in common. And I think there's tremendous, tremendous crossover. As you said, that idea of displacement, also the idea of witness, both in terms of what we witness and how we carry on with the things that we witness, how we're changed by these things. For me, my life changed extremely in Bosnia after I came back from Bosnia. I don't know whether I would call it a crisis of personality or what, but I did become a completely different person. I don't think that's a negative thing. I think it's something that would happen invariably to anybody in this situation. And I realized in coming back from Bosnia, and it was the period in which I met this man whom I'm talking about in that section, I was a completely different person. Had we met under different circumstances, it's anybody's guess. But because we had not similar backgrounds, not similar experiences, but we had both been through, obviously to very varying degrees, some type of really life-changing and difficult periods. And that is the period in which we sort of found each other.
Now, when you say, I wondered whether I would recognize him by his bones.
Mm-hmm.
You've been wondering since you have been excavating and digging up not very deep buried bodies. And because they haven't been buried deep, the flesh is worn away first.
Right.
So when you look in the mirror, you are wondering, how will you be recognized?
Yes.
A scar will not be an identity point because the skin will have rotted.
Absolutely.
And so you're thinking about teeth and bone structure and the cavity of the eyes. And also you're bringing into a sexual situation a level of that connection between sex and death that has to be traumatically transformative.
Absolutely.
Of your experience with another person.
Absolutely. You know, on one level, after I did this work, and as you've said, many of the bodies with which I came into contact There was sort of a range of the state in which we found them. Some were all completely decomposed. Some were not so much. And it was sort of, it was a fascinating thing to me, and it was also a very formative thing to me to consider what is it that is left, you know, of the self, what is left of the body. And with the bodies, I would look at what we had and I would think, you know, how can you recognize? How would it be possible if a woman comes and she's looking for her son and on 10 tables you have, you know, skeletal matter laid out? Obviously she's not going to be able to hone in on that one, or you wouldn't think so. And yet at the same time, you can tell differences. I learned some very amazing and fascinating things when I was there. You can tell age. You can tell past trauma, for example, if someone has broken a bone. You can tell sex. So there are many indicators there. There were also indicators in terms of the effects that we found, the personal effects that were buried with the bodies. For myself, I realized that after I left Bosnia, I was really never able to look at the human body in the same way. I was never able to look at my face or my teeth or anything else in the same way without thinking. And it's perhaps on one level a rather maudlin preoccupation to wonder. But I had sort of somehow gotten into the practice of it. And maybe in a way it tainted everything else. And it certainly tainted my relationship with him. Getting back sort of to this idea of the people who disappear, of the people who go missing, of people who are suddenly erased from your life, how would you recognize them? If their identification cards are taken away, if their dog tags are taken away, if they are buried alone and naked in the wilderness, how do you recognize that person? Today we have all sorts of ways to recognize, to identify. At the same time, what you were talking about in Bosnia Herzegovina and Croatia, you were talking about such numbers and such confusion and such chaos that it was highly possible for someone to just simply disappear and never be found. Never be found. And so that was something that maybe in a sense it worried me, it preoccupied me. And it certainly, I think that my dealings in that relationship, certainly, especially because it came so quickly on the heels of my time in Bosnia, it was permeated by the work that I had done.
But as a writer in trying to, because, you know, this relationship is providing a thematic finale
right
to the book. And it seems, you know, excavation, the discovery of the body of a stranger,
right,
what the relationship is between a body and a corpse.
Right.
All these things have become metaphorical themes in the book, coming
right
to a culmination. So, and to some extent, they're perfect. You know, I'm interested in finding out when it was that you discovered
right
that the themes of your life and the themes of the book we're
right
coming together.
You know, it's interesting because in a way I'm discovering some of them now.
Mm.
There are things that I was not aware of at the time that I was writing that became, they just stood out in Technicolor to me once the thing was done. There were certain things that were done, I think, almost subconsciously that I didn't realize as I was writing. And as far as that last part of the book thematically, I think it does have a lot to do with how little or how much you can ever know another person and how much excavation you are allowed to do with another person, how much they should allow you to come into, let's say, those private areas of their life, the things that they don't choose to talk a lot about. My father was not a reticent man by any stretch of the imagination, and at the same time he was very quiet about these things. He was very sort of he was very hurt about these things, and he suffered a lot because of them even today. And it is interesting that thematically I come back to that in that last section,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
because much of that is the same. I was talking about somebody who had been in a war for 4 years who did not necessarily wish to share all of those things or the things that he had seen, who needed to maintain a little bit of space as far as that was concerned. I think there's a good side to the metaphorical excavation. I think there's a bad side to the metaphorical excavation. As far as my father, it was extremely difficult to answer my questions. After a while, what we did is I would make up a list of questions for him to answer. He knew I was writing this book. He was tremendously positive about it. And he would answer the questions speaking into a cassette recorder because it was too difficult for him to sit face-to-face to answer the questions. He was much more comfortable doing it speaking into, you know, a plastic recording device, which I do understand. And he would then mail me the cassettes. I would listen to them, and then I'd write up more questions based on the things that he had told me. At the same time, you know, on the one hand, you could call it maybe cathartic, or I think it was in some ways very important to my father. On the other hand, I'm also very conscious of the fact that I brought all of that stuff up for him again. I think we live in an age right now where it's all about telling everything or opening everything or letting it all out. And I think, you know, it depends on the person. And certainly it depends on the writer, the extent to which they choose to do that, either as far as themselves and certainly as far as their families if they're writing nonfiction. And I know that even as my questions were good for him, and even as he was happy to answer them, it was also very difficult for him. And so that excavation, it was based on knowledge that I sensed, not the things that I knew. And I was very lucky that my dad was extremely forthcoming with me, and that he did, in the end, ultimately wish to get these things off of his chest and to discuss them. But at the same time, to apply that, let's say, across the board to all people, it wouldn't be like that. And so I think as a writer, as a human being and as a writer, you decide what to give and what to hold back. And I think that's a very important part of being a human being and of being a writer in the end.
I've been speaking with Courtney Angela Berkich, author most recently of The Stone Fields, a memoir, its subtitle, An Epitaph for the Living. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
You can read an excerpt from The Stone Fields on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.